Chapter 2. Working Man Blues. Men are losing ground in the labour market. In May 2019, I was moderating a panel discussion on inequality at a conference organised by the Federal Reserve. I asked Melissa Carney, a top-notch economist, whether she was more worried about women or men. She took a moment. I'd sprung the question on her in front of a highly influential audience. I am really worried about the extent to which men in the US are being pushed to the side of economic, social, and family life, she responded. For 20, 30, or 40 years, scholars focused on women and children. Now we'd really need to think about men. Carney was brave to say it, and she is right. If we want a more dynamic economy and a better future for our children, we need to help the men who are struggling. In Chapter 1, I describe the challenge they face in schools. Here, I turn to jobs. Growing numbers of men are detaching from paid work. For most of those who are in a job, wages have stagnated. In fact, one reason that the gender pay gap has narrowed is that median male pay has fallen, surely a suboptimal way to achieve equality. But while women have been catching up with men, workers on the top rungs of the economic ladder, men as well as women, have been pulling away from everyone else. The deepest fissures in the labour market are not those between men and women. They are between white and black workers and between the upper middle class and the middle and working class, the subjects of chapters 4 and 5. Susan Faludi writes, "Many in the women's movement and in the mass media complain that men just don't want to give up the reins of power. But that would seem to have little applicability to the situations of most men who individually feel not the reins of power in their hands, but its bit in their mouths." I describe and explain here the declining economic fortunes of these men. It's very important to see how these result from the fracturing of the labour market rather than the frailties of the men themselves. It's a structural problem, not a personal one. Missing men. Over the last three decades, write economists David Auter and Melanie Wasserman, the labour market trajectory of males in the US has turned downward along four dimensions: skills acquisition, employment rates, occupational stature, and real wage levels. If that sounds bad, it is. Labour force participation among men in the US has dropped by 7 percentage points over the last half century, from 96% to 89%. Even before COVID cratered the economy in 2020, there were 9 million men of prime working age who were not in employment. Economists define the prime years as beginning at the age of 25 and ending, unnervingly, at 54. A technical but important point is that most of the men who are not in work don't count in official statistics as unemployed, because they aren't looking for work. One in three men with only a high school education are now out of the labour force. That's 5 million men, a reserve army of labour twice the size of the People's Liberation Army of China. If you think of a man hit by economic trends, chances are that you have a middle-aged man in mind. But the problem is not just one for older men. The biggest fall in male employment has in fact been among young men, aged between 25 and 34. Now, that is prime age. Scholars are not sure why. Standard economic models struggle to explain it. One popular explanation is the attraction of video games. And it's easy to see how Assassin's Creed could seem like a better way to spend your day than in a poorly paid, unappealing job. But there isn't really any good evidence for this. A careful analysis of time use data by University of North Carolina economist Gray Kimbrough finds that hours spent gaming have increased the most among men in their 20s, but from just 3 hours a week in 2005 to 6 hours a week in 2015. Based on my own experience as a father of three sons, I honestly had to double check that these numbers were really for hours per week rather than hours per day. The figure does not strike me as justification for a moral panic. Kimbrough also shows that men who leave employment do not increase the hours spent gaming, or at least not immediately. The economic downturn of 2020 obviously caused employment levels for both men and women to plummet, as lockdowns put the economy into a state of suspended animation. In the space of just a few weeks, female employment fell by 16% and male employment dropped by 13%. The difference was partly the result of more women taking time away from employment to care for children, especially as schools and childcare providers closed. And the downturn was quickly dubbed a she-cession. Certainly the 2020 recession was a departure from recent economic downturns, in which women's employment declines were barely perceptible, as Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson observes. Most previous recessions have in fact been he-cessions, hitting male employment hardest. But since the 2020 downturn was generated artificially by a pandemic rather than by the usual economic cycle, the recovery was extremely rapid too. The COVID-19 recession was very sharp, but very short, lasting just 2 months, less than any previous downturn in US history. The gender gap closed very quickly too. By October 2021, the 1.2 percentage point decline in labor force participation rates since the start of the pandemic was evenly divided between men and women. There was some good news too. The proportion of female senior executives rose to 24% in 2020, up from 21% in 2019. Robots and trade. Male employment has not fallen because men have suddenly become feckless or work shy, but because of shifts in the structure of the economy. Simply put, male jobs have been hit by a 1-2 punch of automation and free trade. Machines pose a greater threat to working men than to women for two reasons. First, the occupations most susceptible to automation are just more likely to employ men, as my colleague Mark Murrow shows. As he writes, men make up over 70% of production occupations, over 80% of transportation occupations, and over 90% of construction and installation occupations. And these are, as he says, all occupational groups with current task loads that have above average projected automation exposure. By contrast, women make up most of the workforce in relatively automation-safe occupations such as healthcare, personal services, and education. Second, men often lack the skills required in an automating world. According to Andy Haldane, chief economist at the Bank of England, the high-skill, high-paid jobs of the future may involve skills better measured by EQ, a measure of emotional intelligence, than IQ. There is already evidence that the female advantage in soft skills is giving them an additional boost in the US labor market, and that they are switching more quickly than men to robot-proof occupations. It is important to note, however, that there is a lot of uncertainty about the likely impact of automation. Empirical estimates vary widely. Fears about automation have been around for a long time, and they're often a proxy for a broader pessimism about economic trends. One thing is certain. The long-run shift away from jobs requiring physical strength is going to continue. Fewer than 1 in 10 jobs now require what the Bureau of Labor Statistics describes as heavy work, which requires occasionally lifting or carrying 51 to 100 pounds or frequently lifting or carrying 26 to 50 pounds. As the muscular demands of work decline, men are becoming physically weaker. One study of grip strength, a good marker of overall strength, shows a sharp decline among men. Meanwhile, and perhaps more surprisingly, women are getting physically stronger. In 1985, the average man in his early 30s could squeeze your hand with about 30 pounds more force than a similarly aged woman. Today, their grip strength is about the same. The goal here is not to bring back brawny jobs for men. It is to help men adapt. Most of the occupations set to grow the most in coming years are female-dominated. There has been a commendable and largely successful push to get more girls and women into jobs that require STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math. But it is now even more important to encourage men into what I call HEAL jobs, health, education, administration, and literacy, which are dominated by women. Male workers are challenged on one side by robots and on the other by workers in other countries. Free trade has become a hot political topic in recent years, especially in the US and the UK. It is hard to untangle the empirical knots here. There's no doubt that Chinese imports caused declines in US manufacturing employment of around 2 to 3 million jobs. Arguments continue, however, over whether there were offsetting increases in other kinds of jobs, how much the impact was restricted to certain places, especially the Midwest, whether the shock was short-term for just a few years after 2001 when China joined the World Trade Organization, or has had longer-lasting effects, and whether the reduced geographical mobility of workers has made matters worse. In other words, it is complicated. It's also very difficult to get a good economic measure of the benefits of cheaper Chinese goods for tens of millions of consumers, as well as for workers in China, of course, but that is a different argument. I will say that the political elite spent decades complacently arguing that on net and in the long run, free trade is good. And so it is. By definition, however, this means that some people in some places are being hurt right now. Not much was done to help these people, even by centre-left politicians who claim to be on the side of the working class. The assumption in policy circles that some of the winnings from free trade would be redistributed to the losers proved mostly false. The victims were basically left behind, told to buck up their ideas, engage in some lifelong learning, and get with the program. Up until 2017, for every dollar the US government was spending on trade adjustment assistance for workers, $25 were being spent on tax subsidies towards the endowments of elite colleges. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 imposed a tax on the biggest of these funds. In the populist backlash, the technocratic elite largely reaped what they sowed. For men who are in work, pay levels are typically lower than in the past. The median real hourly wage for men peaked sometime in the 1970s and has been falling since. While women's wages have risen across the board over the last four decades, wages for men on most rungs of the earnings ladder have stagnated. Only men at the top have seen strong earnings growth. Men who entered the workforce in 1983 will earn about 10% less in real terms across their working life than those who started out in 1967. For women, by contrast, lifetime earnings have risen by 33% over the same period. These numbers are at the median, in the dry words of the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. The long-term trend in men's earnings has been quite different than that for women. But what about that gender pay gap? When I hire a new research assistant, I ask them to read two books. The first is How to Write Short, Wordcraft for Fast Times by Roy Peter Clark, an excellent guide to sharp communication in a world of blogs and tweets. And yes, I am aware that the book you're listening to is rather long. The other is Factfulness, 10 Reasons We're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think by Hans Rosling, who is something of a hero to me. Rosling, who died in 2017, was a Swedish physician who became obsessed with statistical illiteracy. In Factfulness, he describes various biases, including the straight line instinct, an assumption that a historical trend line will continue unaltered into the future, the negativity instinct, which is a tendency to think things are likely getting worse, and the gap instinct, which is, as he puts it, a basic urge to divide things into two distinct groups with nothing but an empty gap in between. As he puts it, we love to dichotomize. The gap instinct leads to two errors of perception. First, we fail to see how much overlap there is between two groups. Second, we fail to see the bigger gaps that typically exist within groups rather than between them. The gender pay gap is a case in point. A woman at the middle of the female wage distribution, for full-time year-round workers, earns 82% as much as a man at the middle of the male one. In 2020, $891 and $1,082 a week, respectively. When we hear about this gap, the thought that naturally gets generated is women earn less than men. But in fact, the distribution of women's wages looks strikingly similar to the distribution of men's wages, and a lot more similar today than just a few decades ago. In fact, 40% of women now earn more than the typical man, up from just 13% in 1979. That 2 in 5 women are earning more than what 50% of men earn seems counterintuitive to many people. In June 2021, I polled my Twitter followers, asking them what proportion of female workers they thought earned more than the median man. 10%, 20%, 30%, or 40%? The poll got just 264 votes, so I'm not going to make any scientific claims here. But my followers, being an academic kind of crowd, are likely better informed on this kind of thing than most. But still, the votes were in order for 20%, 10%, 30%, and finally the correct answer of 40%. The gap instinct is strong. These wage trends illustrate the other danger of gap instinct thinking, which is to miss the extent of differences within groups. The wage distributions of men and women overlap more than in 1979, but they're also much more spread out. The gap between high-wage women and low-wage women, and to a lesser extent between high-wage and low-wage men, has widened dramatically. The closeness of the male and female wage distributions is, of course, stupendously good news on the gender equality front. The last half century has seen what Claudia Goldin calls a grand gender convergence, with a dramatic narrowing in the gap between men and women, not only in earnings, but in employment levels, hours worked, and occupation type. It is also true that in recent years, however, progress on closing the pay gap has slowed, despite women's success in the classroom. So what's causing the remaining gap? The answer to this question matters a lot, especially when it comes to potential solutions. The basic facts are not in dispute. As I've already said, the typical, i.e. the median, full-time female worker earns about 82% as much as the typical man. The question is why? Here, things quickly get heated. For the feminist left, the pay gap proves patriarchy. As Tony Van Pelt, president of the National Organization of Women, says, "The wage gap is a blatantly unfair vestige of a patriarchal labor system that haunts women's economic potential throughout their lives." Conservatives, meanwhile, dismiss the idea of a pay gap as a feminist myth, used to create the impression of inequalities that simply do not exist. The wage gap is a massively discredited factoid, says Christina Hoff Summers of the American Enterprise Institute. Summers is not alone. In a 2019 survey, 46% of men and 30% of women said the problem of unequal pay was made up to serve a political purpose. The pay gap accurately describes the difference in the economic resources available to individual men and women in the middle of their respective wage distributions. It is not a myth, it is math. The real disagreement is not over whether the typical woman earns less than typical man, but why. Conservatives point to studies showing that once a range of factors influencing pay are taken into account, hours, industry, experience, seniority, location, and so on, the pay gap almost evaporates. Various studies of this kind put the adjusted gender pay gap at around 5%. In a foreword to a 2009 study commissioned by the federal government, Deputy Assistant Labor Secretary Charles James concluded that the raw wage gap should not be used as the basis to justify corrective action. Indeed, there may be nothing to correct. There is certainly very little evidence that women are paid less than men for doing the same work in the same way. Women are paid less because they do different work, or work differently, or both. But of course, that's not the end of the story. Women may earn less because they occupy fewer senior positions, but that fact itself may be the result of institutional sexism. Similarly, it's true that women tend to be more clustered than men in lower-paying occupations and industries, which explains perhaps a third of the pay gap. But that may reflect socialized gender roles, not least in terms of family responsibilities, or a devaluation of work that is done by women, or both. In any case, while there is a pay gap between occupations, there is as big a gender pay gap within occupations. The pay gap is a parenting gap. The one word explanation for the pay gap is children. Among young adults, especially if they are childless, the pay gap has essentially disappeared. As The Economist Marianne Bertrand writes, There's remarkable evidence that earnings for men and women move in sync up to the birth of a couple's first child. This is when women lose and they never recover. To make matters worse, the crucial years for wage gains are from the mid-30s onward, which, as Michelle Budig, another top economist in the field, points out, is the same period when intensive family responsibilities, particularly for mothers, are in full force. The earnings trajectory for women who do not have children looks similar to that for men. The one for mothers does not. The more children women have, the further behind they fall in terms of both employment and earnings. Some of the best proof that the gender pay gap is mostly a parenting pay gap comes from innovative studies in Sweden and Norway comparing new mothers in same-sex relationships with those in heterosexual relationships. Ylva Mulberry, from the Swedish Institute for Evaluation of Labour Market and Education Policy, shows that the impact on earnings for the birth mother is almost identical in both family types. Meanwhile, the non-birth mothers in the lesbian couples show a similar earnings pattern to fathers in the heterosexual ones. Over time, the inequality seems to balance out in the lesbian couple if they have more than one child, as each takes their turn at being the birth mother. For heterosexual couples, by contrast, the gap gets wider with each child. A study of bus and train drivers working for the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority by Valentin Bolotny and Natalia Emanuel, a duo of Harvard economists, provides some strong evidence here too. Women account for 30% of the drivers and on average earn 89 cents for every dollar earned by their male peers. By focusing on men and women doing the same job for the same employer, Bolotny and Emanuel can tease out the various factors contributing to wage differences. They conclude that the pay gap can be explained entirely by the fact that while having the same choice sets in the workplace, women and men make different choices. The men were twice as likely to work overtime, which pays extra, even at short notice. They also took fewer hours of unpaid leave and so on. Among train drivers with children, the gaps were even wider. Fathers wanted even more overtime pay. Mothers wanted more time off. In some ways, it makes most sense to look at women at the top of the ladder, since they have the widest choices and the greatest economic power. Take women who leave Harvard with a professional or postgraduate degree, arguably members of the most elite educational group in the world. 15 years after graduating, only half of these women are working full-time. What happened? Claudia Goldin, who studied this group in detail, says, "After facing down so many obstacles, after gaining countless freedoms, the obstruction that had always been there became crystal clear. The barrier is the time bind. Children require time. Careers require time." Or take University of Chicago MBAs. Straight out of the business school, women earned about 12% less than their male classmates, a gap largely explained by the kind of jobs chosen. 13 years later, the difference had widened dramatically to about 38%. But one subgroup of the female MBAs had not fallen further behind. By now, you don't need me to tell you which. The ones without children. For most women, having a child is the economic equivalent of being hit by a meteorite. For most men, it barely makes a dent. The question arises as to whether these different roles are freely chosen or not. I'll dig into this question more later. For now, I'll say that the mothers of young children seem to want more time at home. In the Chicago MBA study I just cited, the women most likely to reduce their working hours were those with the highest earning husbands. But even if there is a real preference being expressed here, two points need to be added. First, the labour market price paid for this choice doesn't need to be as high as it is. Second, once children are older, there is a good case for fathers doing more on the home front. The $2 trillion woman. We have women to thank, and especially mothers to thank, for fueling economic growth for at least a generation. In 2019, women accounted for 47% of all workers. The US economy is $2 trillion larger than it would have been had women's economic participation remained at 1970 levels, according to a 2015 report from the Council of Economic Advisers. For families on modest or low incomes, the rise of women's work and wages has also blunted some of the pain of men's economic decline. As the council concluded, essentially all of the income gains that middle-class American families have experienced since 1970 are due to the rise in women's earnings. The biggest change in employment has been among married women with children. In 1970, most mothers were not in paid work. Today, almost 3 out of 4 are. Even among the mothers of preschoolers, paid work is now the norm rather than the exception. Women account for around half the managerial positions in the US economy. Many previously male-dominated professions, including medicine and financial management, are rapidly tilting female, especially among younger professionals. The proportion of women lawyers has increased tenfold, from 4% in 1980 to 43% in 2020. The shift has taken place not just in economic activities, but in economic aspirations and expectations. In 1968, only 33% of young women in their teens and early 20s said they expected to be in paid work at the age of 35. By 1980, the share was 80%, and the question has now been dropped from the survey. The idea that women will pursue professional and economic goals has gone from novelty to commonplace. When was the last time you heard the term career woman? As Hannah Rosin writes in The End of Men, the 200,000-year period in which men have been top dog is truly coming to an end. The global economy is becoming a place where women are more successful than men. Wait, what? Women becoming more successful than men? No wonder Rosin got so much heat when her book was published. As she observed later, feminists don't like the argument because they say it makes it seem as though women have totally won and there isn't anything more to worry about. This is not Rosin's view, however, and it is not mine either. There is plenty to worry about in terms of women's opportunities, including in the higher reaches of the economy. Just 1 in 5 C-suite company directors is a woman, and just 41 of the Fortune 500 firms have a female CEO. That is certainly better than the number in 1995, which was 0. But it's still shockingly low. The share of venture capital money going to female founders is 3%. So yes, there is more work to do for women, especially at the apex of the economy. But lower down the economic ladder, it is often the men who are struggling. Over the last few decades, girls and women have shot past men in school and on college campuses. On the economic front, many men, though not the elite ones, have also lost ground as women have surged ahead. This has had important consequences for broader culture, especially in terms of family life. The economic rise of women has dramatically altered the terms of trade between the sexes. Many men are struggling to adjust.